Jeremy, thank you for sharing those words with us. Hare, Dante, Daphne, thank you all for reading for us this morning. Christian and Myra, thank you for offering communion. We give thanks for all of the many gifts that are among us, especially the gifts of our children. Jeremy, your story presses us to think about privilege and conversion. And so we give thanks for the vulnerability and we hold space with you. It was approaching 3 a.m. and we were still nowhere near the end of our conversation. And although we'd been talking since 9 p.m., I wasn't going to let him go just yet. I mean, not after all the inflammatory things he kept saying. I needed to respond to each one of them. See, I'd built a pretty good intellectual system that kept me going for about 18 years. And he was coming for all of it. The Bible, he said, was compiled without you in mind. You sure you want to keep it? Religion's super violent. Why are you adamant that you have the truth? Dude, you're Liberian. Are you going to sit here and not challenge white Jesus? You see the harm it's caused in your country. He kept going in the world that I constructed, the world with the wall of privilege, both theological and political, cultural and social, began to crumble. See, it all started because my RAs decided that it would be a great idea, Karen, to invite a philosopher of religion to talk to a bunch of freshmen about the Morehouse Way. Fun fact, he didn't stay on topic. And instead, he came for our beliefs. I was so annoyed. Fortunately, his talk only lasted an hour. Most people left, but I stuck around. I had a few questions for him. He'd obviously struck a nerve. I wanted to know why he said stuff like that, why he shaded a preacher that I like. Why was he so critical? He was so annoying to me at that time. He agitated me. I said that I liked the preacher he shaded. He was someone who spoke to me and helped me to be a better warrior for Christ. And before I could continue that sentence, he said, "A warrior for Christ? Who is Christ and what is a warrior and how does one become a warrior for Christ?" I stumbled through some answer, but with every answer that emerged, another question. I would later learn that this method was Socratic. But at the time, I was just deeply frustrated. Dr. Ilya Davis was really, really agitating me, really poking holes in my giant theological bag of water. He pressed and he pressed and he pressed and things got really heated. And finally, I said to him, "Why don't you want me to believe in Jesus anymore?" I said, "This is why people don't go to liberal arts colleges. I knew I should have just stayed my butt in Louisiana trying to steal my faith. They warned me about you." And without skipping a beat, he said, "Boy, you barely even know Jesus. All you know about Jesus is secondhand. You can never fully know Jesus until you think critically about the life of Jesus. Until you examine Jesus and know the real life implications of his life. The only way you can know Jesus," he continued, "is by actually studying Jesus critically and the religion critically and constructing your own image of Jesus for yourself that holds in tension your blackness, your maleness, your Africanness, your passions. I want you to meet Jesus for yourself. I want you to see Jesus and see the depth of Jesus in his life, the depth of critical thought in his preaching, the revolutionary spirit in his ministry. I want you to know the Jesus that got killed and know the reason behind it. I want you to know the Jesus that our ancestors saw that sustained them through slavery and segregation. I want you to know that Jesus. And I don't care what you have to throw out, what you have to break, what you have to tear apart to experience that Jesus. Look," he said, "I'm standing here with you because I was once blinded by this theology too. And now that I see all of the pain and the suffering in this world and the ways in which our thinking keeps it intact, I don't care how much I agitate you. But I refuse to let your harmful beliefs go unchecked. And in that moment, the tears were running down my eyes, and I could feel the scales falling from my eyes. I could feel the stones falling from my heart. I could feel the walls crumbling from my mind. I could feel the transformation happening in my life, conversion in my bones. Paul feels it too. In our text this morning, it says that Paul was breathing threats and murder on his way to imprison and bind people up for following the way. He had asked for the authority from the temple to make it happen, and he had the papers, he had the approval, he had the legitimacy, the law, and the policy, the orders to persecute. And so he journeyed on the road to Damascus with heartlessness and evil in his heart. He journeyed on the road to Damascus with the intent to bind and the intent to kill and the intent to tear families apart and rigidly enforce his interpretation of the law. He carried all of that with him. So you can see him as he walks confidently down that Damascus road. A powerful group of people with him, powerful papers in his hands as he's empowered to police the freedom and agency of others. And it is right here in the middle of his high step of hypocrisy that the text tells us that there was a great flash of light and he fell down to the ground. And while that might confuse you and I, it did not confuse him. He was a good Jewish man, so he knew that something godly was happening. In the scriptures, God often spoke in these theophanic ways where lightning would flash or the earth would shake. So he asks this question. He looks up, "Who is it, Lord?" For he knew that this was certainly from God. And so the voice responded and said, "I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting." After these words, Paul was left speechless and blind, helpless and immobile. He went from breathing threats of murder to being led by the hand to the house of one of Jesus's followers. Willie Jennings, who we have been journeying along with us with, describes this event in the following way. He says that it is important for us to realize that before Paul had this experience, Paul was no doubt a killer. He had the authority to take life in the form of death or imprisonment. Jennings said that Paul was dangerous because not only did he have the authority to kill, but he also had the mind to do it. He wanted to do it. And Paul, he says, was a closed circle of inner logic that justified violence, death, and harm. He continues and says that in order for violence to be smooth and elegant and seemingly natural, it needs people like Paul. People who are closed circles that use the logic to justify death and violence, who have the mind to kill. But Jennings says that the closed circle that is Paul is broken open by God. Yes, he says, a murderer is stopped in his tracks, but more importantly, the rationality for his murderous actions were shattered too. Too often in our world, we miss the harm and violence that is tied up in particular ways of thinking. We think that theology is ethereal and esoteric, and so we forget that it has visceral consequences in this world. We say, like I said to my professor, "What's the harm in how I think? Won't you just let me think what I want to think?" And we should be free to think what we want to think, but our thinking needs to be challenged. And I think what Paul experiences, the question that Willie Jennings poses to us, is that our beliefs must be interrogated because our beliefs have consequences. What you believe about God matters. It almost matters as much as what you do about your belief in God. And then sometimes your belief about God dictates how you act in this world. If we believe that God gives us the authority to persecute and to kill, then we will persecute and kill. If we believe that God has given us wealth and privilege because we are special, then we will hold on to that at all costs. If we believe that God has given us this land and has taken it away from other people, then we will justify their slaughtered and their continued oppressing. If we believe that God made our sexual organs only for procreation and all other pleasures must be restrained, we will restrain everybody else's pleasures. If we believe that bodies must be controlled, then guess what? We will control bodies. So this text helps us to see that the most important thing about Paul's conversion, the most important thing about the wall of privilege falling, is that Paul gets to recognize the need for this change. Paul gets to see and experience a new way of thinking and have a different set of beliefs. I don't assume that all of y'all follow my Facebook very closely. But this week, I was quite active on Facebook because I was engaged in a public belief campaign. See, a bunch of pastors, a bunch of black pastors, met with Donald Trump. Now, of course, you may say, Elijah, why do you care? They don't go to your church. You don't know them. But there are a bunch of black pastors who, for the most part, are pretty respected in our community. A lot of them had pretty large churches, and a lot of them had even larger outreaches. A bunch of people read their books, go to the conferences that they have. They tell people things about dating, things about their lives. And so these people are deeply influential. So they met with Trump. And through social media and text messages, I began to challenge why they would meet with him. So many folks hit me up. They couldn't see why it was such a big deal. They said, Elijah, shouldn't we pray for our enemies? Is anyone too outside of the love of God? Don't we have to go places even if we don't want to, if God sends us? All of those questions were good questions, but I pointed them to the transcript. And I reminded them that in the scriptures, the prophets did meet with the kings, but the prophets told the kings the truth regardless of the price. Moses used his privilege to stand in the presence of Pharaoh and say, God has heard the cries of my people, so you must let my people go. Nathan stood before David and told him this story about stealing stuff from a poor person and said, you are the man that has stolen that. Amos stood in the midst of the public square and says, God hates your worship because you refuse to let justice roll down like waters. The prophets engage oppressive people, but they never cower to them. They never cowered to them. And right now, the popular theology, the thing that a lot of Christians believe in America, is a theology that I will call cowardice. It is a theology that is accommodationist. The logic of Christians right now, the logic that Christians have accepted right now, is that it is good to be at any table, and it does not matter what is happening at that table. It does not matter if death is planned at that table. It does not matter if mass incarceration is strategized at that table. If deportations are scheduled at that table. If families are ripped apart at that table. If integrity is crucified at that table. Right now, the prevailing belief is that it's okay just to sit at any table. And that belief is causing harm in this world. And so many of us are participating in that. And it's not just that group of clergy. And the church is at fault because we have allowed that type of theology to go unchecked. We have not challenged it. We have failed to teach people the way and show them a good process of thinking. We have removed ourselves from the mess of interrogating beliefs, so we have allowed trash theology to fester. in this world. We have allowed trash theology to fester in this world. But Willie Jennings helps us again. He asks us to pay close attention to what is happening in this text, and he says that no rationale for killing can remain intact in the presence of God. He says that there is a holy question that comes directly to Paul and is too massive for him to handle because it is an intimate one, one with holy fire. The question, he says, is this: why are you hurting me? He says, in this world, that question often comes from the mouth of poor and women and children. But this question casts light on the currency of death that we incessantly traffic in, and it has no good answer other than to stop. This question, he says, is God's question. Why are you hurting me? This question is Jesus's question. Hurt and pain have reached their final destination in the body of Jesus. And Jesus isn't just some dead pretender to the messianic throne, but Jesus is alive and well and feeling the pain of all those who hurt. And Jesus asks, why are you hurting me? That is the question that Paul is converted by. That is the question that Paul walks away from privilege because of. That is the question that Paul is converted to seeing a new world view. Paul is converted to seeing the pain and the suffering in this world as though it is God's very own pain and suffering and hardship. He is converted to seeing his own actions, his own hostility towards others as hostility towards God. And he spends the rest of his life trying to alleviate suffering in this world from this moment on. Paul sees the question, why do you harm me? And the scales fall from his eyes. So my question today is this. What if the question, why do you harm me, was the question that thrusted how Christians talked about conversion and life and faithfulness to Jesus? What if we asked this question daily and regularly and publicly? How would it look in our society if we took God's question seriously? Why do you harm me? How would our families look if we listened when someone said to us that your belief is harming my life, my personhood? How could our families be converted if we could say to the ones that we hold dearly that everything about my life that you say that you believe, the way that you treat me and my partner, is harming us? How would our families be able to flourish if gay folks could say to our families that your beliefs harm me and that's grounds enough for them to stop in their tracks? What would it look like for black folks to be able to say to white people that white supremacy and white privilege and white indifference and white ignorance is prolonging harm in this world? What would it look like to ask this question, why do you harm me? And for that to be enough to convert someone out of their violence. My friends, I believe with every fiber of my bones that the most important thing that the Church of Jesus Christ can do and say is to ask this question of how do we harm and how do we minimize it and how do we end it, and to ask this question of one another and to ask this question of the world. It's a huge project, I know, but people continue to suffer because harm and the logic that justifies it goes unchallenged in this world. And we hear the voice of Jesus speaking from the Damascus Road, "Why do you harm me?" And I hope that question grips us to leap from our seats of privilege, to stop in our path of oppression, and be converted to the new way of following Jesus.